Oh, Stephen, isn't this fun? Of course it is. It's Happy Times and Places, an extremely positive, but don't forget, it's deadly, podcast in which I, Toby Haydock, try to extol the virtues of a Doctor Who story chosen by a friend of mine and commentate along the way, seeing if I can guess what my guest's favourite thing about each episode might be.
Hi, Toby. Thanks for having me on to talk about why I like the Celestial Toymaker.
Welcome. It's time for episode 2, The Hall of Dolls. Episode 2, that is, of The Celestial Toymaker, which has been chosen by Kieran Hyman, who I haven't seen for ages. He sent me this tape a long time ago, when this podcast was less than half its present size. And by one of those glorious coincidences, as I record this today, which is... Well, it's now seeped into Friday the 3rd of November, but it still counts. I've been up since Thursday the 2nd of November. And today is the day they have announced the colorization and truncation of the first Dalek story to present it as part of the Doctor Who 60th anniversary celebrations. And one of the people involved in it is Kieran Hyman. So how funny that I should have plucked his... story. Well, no, because his story is in the air as well because of the return of the Celestial Toymaker. It's just one of those another of those happy coincidences that human beings and particularly Doctor Who fans see patterns in all sorts of things. But I just liked seeing his name pop up, especially with all this exciting news. As I currently record this, if you are a non-patron, I mean, this will be old news. By the time this comes out, Shooting Atwell will probably have announced his departure from the role. I do hope not. We haven't seen him yet. Hopefully it's only about 6 months. 6 months between now and when you will listen to this. So I try not to. Apologies that this Celestial Toymaker one has been a bit embedded in the time that it is recorded. I try for that not to be the case. These are not, you know, reflections of what is happening outside these four walls. It's very much concentrated on what's happening on the screen that I'm watching. But I can't help be carried away with everything that's going on for the 60th, which I suppose will be a distant memory by the time you listen to this. But I'm certainly having fun. Just at the moment, there's so much buzz, there's so much anticipation, there's so much love for the old series, which I really enjoy. It's not all about it being a brave new world. There's, it's reaching back and, paying homage to, you know, the people who, you know, put those building blocks down. And I think that's, you know, that's, and I know there's often been some resistance to that within the BBC, is, you know, and I think for a while, you know, the old series, and the new series could not consort and could be spoken of in the same breath. But I think those dark days are over, and I'm sure Russell T. Davies has a lot to do with that. So I'm feeling all rather loved up about the whole situation, which is delightful. And with that, I'm going to go into episode 2 of one of my least favourite Doctor Who stories. Only because, not because I don't hugely approve of what it's trying to do, but I think, you know, the manner in which it has done has, you know, one or two times I've really, you know, tried to watch it properly, as opposed to having it on, you know, as a soundtrack in my ears, but to actually, you know, imagine what the story would have looked like. Its flaws have become very apparent to me, and I've been cheering it on, going, oh, do something more than just literally play the games. So let's see how we do, because lest I forget, the whole point of this podcast is to accentuate the positive and to see the good and to see why we love Doctor Who in all its forms. So let us begin now. I'm going to press play on The Celestial Toymaker, Part 2, The Hall of Dolls, in 3, 2, 1. Well, here we are. I mean, it is a very creative period, this, in the show's history. I mean, we're just, and actually then going into a rather uncreative period. I like the Innes Lloyd and indeed the Patrick Troughton era, but I don't think it's anything like as innovative as the Tosh Wiles season three. And I don't know if it, Tosh Wiles' regime could have lasted. It certainly couldn't have done because of the personnel. As I think we've already discussed, John Wiles and William Hartnell did not see eye to eye. John Wiles was not happy doing the show. But I love their ambition. Would it have been a little bit too strange, a little bit too abstract, a little bit too optimistic in what it expects from the audience, in that a lot of the stories are very different, but there's, you know, the tales that are grown up are really grim and really, you know, quite hard hitting for what they are. The tales that are philosophical are quite sort of thoughtful and erudite, and the tales that are out there, well, I think this is where the issue, as I say, is with this, is that it promises to be out there and then it doesn't quite have the courage of its convictions, and I suspect its courage was erased, you know, was dealt a blow by the pen of Jerry Davis, who's come in and I think, you know, rewritten this and turned it into the literal board games. And we don't know if that was better or worse. It could have been that it was a great idea not well realized in Brian Hales' script, because Brian Hales got a lot of rewriting. I know Terence Dix, you know, said that he pretty much had to do a, you know, top to bottom rewrite of The Seeds of Death. I think the Peladons seem to have gone okay, but I think, yeah, Seeds of the Smugglers doesn't seem to have had much trouble. Nobody really talks about the Smugglers at all, full stop. But certainly this has been messed about with. But so here we go. Hartnell is on holiday. Albert Ward has previously played the Doctor's hands in The Romans. and they must have remembered it. They must have thought he's got excellent Hartnell hands and brought him back. And it does seem, I mean, I suppose, I was going to say it's a waste of Michael Gough, but actually if your leading man is just a disembodied voice, and essentially is being, you know, talked to in his absence by another character, you want it to be an actor who has a mesmerizing presence and some hefty clout. Is that where the Doctor, that is, that's where the Doctor issues a warning, isn't it, to Stephen and Dodo, but he doesn't deliver the line like it's just been cut off, and nobody's directed Hartnell properly. So it's a real misread that that sort of stays in. Is it something like he says, you know, go to chair number or something, whatever it is. He doesn't say it like it's being cut off. I do think the Trilogic Games movement noise does sound a bit like the opening refrain of the Are You Being Served theme, because Are You Being Served, for listeners from abroad, I'm sure you know, the picture's just come up of Michael Gough with the cards. There's something so evocative about cards. They look absolutely magnificent when used as a part of illustrations to, and it's actually happened with the latest Celestial Toymaker, hasn't it? They use playing cards, and they look somehow strange and beguiling, and yet they're an everyday thing. We've all played cards, but to turn them, I mean, and I think the genius of this, to turn them into people. I mean, I would, you know, if you were to do this today, you would actually have them as walking playing cards, wouldn't you? I think that would be a terrific way of doing it, is of actually having them like the are they like that in the Ernest Shepherd drawings? Are they Ernest Shepherd in some of the Alice in Wonderlands? I'm sure there's an Alice in Wonderlands illustrations where the you know, the cards are actually mobile playing cards. Anyway, I was talking about the Trilogic Game and that ping pong 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 ping, and I always think it's I always think it's like the opening music of I Being Served, which is a sitcom overseas viewers set in a sort of department store. And it's got lots of characters, you know, doling out outfits and double entendres. It's a Croft and Perry sitcom. That team anyway, you know, the Dad's Army type. And it's very funny, but it does have a theme tune that begins with the movement of the Trilogic game, because first four tell them something's lady clothes and underwear going up. Anyway, that's probably just me. What other theme tunes can you find in the soundtracks of Doctor Who? I do actually, although I lament the fact that they're not actually mobile two-dimensional playing cards given voice, I do think these costumes are great. I think they're, you know, they really do look like, especially Peter Stevens as the Knave of Hearts, but they really do look like, you know, the illustrations of playing cards come to life. I think they're terrific. And the actors all do a very good job. Campbell Singer's playing the King as an old duffer. Carmen Silvera is haughty. Peter Stevens as the Knave is naughty. And Reg Lever is the Jester, who's an actor. I think this is his only episode, isn't it? And he plays it like a sort of music hall turn. He's in a Nigel Neal play called The Road that I adapted for Radio 4. Plays the landlord in that. I think he was long dead before anybody started looking for Doctor Who actors, and he's only in one episode that we can't see. But I'm surprised we've got as many photos as we have. I mean, the recreation that I'm watching has lots of composites, but actually it's so good you can't tell on occasion which are composites and which are actual pictures. But there are more pictures than I remember. I thought I'd seen a lot of pictures from Celestial Toymaker, but there's a lot here that I don't. I have seen this reconstruction before. But some of these pictures are new or surprises to me. So it's done a fabulous job. It's done a fabulous job. And we've got all these different chairs, which is what I rather like about this episode, actually, is each of the chairs has a different method of dispatch. And I think that is perfect for the young audience to sort of anticipate not only whether the next chair is a deadly chair, but what method of deadliness it is going to dispatch upon its unsuspecting users. And I think that's rather fun. If they all just chopped your head off or froze you or whatever, it wouldn't have nearly that sort of grotesque sense of playful fun, which is perfect for, you know, what the Celestial Toymaker should be at its best, which is, you know, perversions, sort of rather sadistic, you know, realistic realizations of what is usually relegated to a board. You know, any dispatch in a board game, you don't actually get killed, you don't actually slide down the stake, you know, but here you would, and it would be a big grotesque snake and you'd want it to sort of gobble you up or gobble the victim up as it got to the bottom. I also enjoy the fact that the TARDIS doors that we see are white, because again, that's a slight perversion of what we're used to, and I think this story works at its best when it takes something that we're used to and, you know, is very bold with making it dissonant and abstract and disjointed to our eyes. Particularly the design is excellent, actually. I mean, we're so lucky with these pictures. These costumes are super. A playing card. She's channeling Lady Bracknell here, isn't she, Carmen Silvera? The actors are having great fun, and it's jolly for them that they get to do different characters every week. Because she can't be that old here either, Carmen Sylvia. I didn't realise until I researched her a while ago that she was actually Canadian. I think she was evacuated from Canada. And Campbell Singer here as the King of Hearts had an illustrious career. We'll maybe talk about him later. But yes, they're certainly, it's certainly what you, I think I mentioned last time, I think is a benefit to the story that all the toy makers' toys are played by the same people. It speaks to the removal of personality in a way that that everybody looks a bit like the last person. It doesn't actually make literal sense within the story, because obviously if they are people that have been captured by the toy maker and have their personalities removed, they would be all different people. But actually the fact that perhaps, you know, his avatars for the souls or whatever of the people that he has, you know, sucked into his world are all based on the same template, Carmen Sylvia and Campbell Singer. I think that adds to, again, this strange, abstract, depersonalizing, even though they're giving quite rich characterizations, because they all look the same, it adds to that sort of depersonalization, which I think is very effective, even though there's nothing dark about these performances. You know, he's a doddery old man, she's a haughty queen. And there is a moment towards the end that I think is rather beautiful, but I wish they perhaps had more opportunity to hint at the sort of melancholy, lurking beneath the fact that these are sort of parodies of the humans they once were. I mean, that. Oh, and right. Okay, I've got to address the elephant in the room now, and it actually has been raised by Kazin, one of my patrons, saying, you know, I hope I point out that the use of the N-word there when Campbell Singer is muttering "eeny meeny miny mo" is, you know, deplorable, and would have been racist for the time. I'm not sure of the value of you know, calling out, making the past account for things that cannot be erased, and I do think it was a different time, and that context is all are reasonable excuses. But I would point out that the lines aren't in the script, but I've seen people online sort of then calling out and trying to see if Campbell Singer was somehow some sort of, you know, a fascist. No, he was saying a nursery rhyme that would have been said by most people living in the UK at that time, whether we like that or not. Now, I don't like it. It's a horrible word. It's a word I would never use. I did hear older people when I was younger use it, and older people who would not have considered themselves racist in any way, and who wouldn't have used the word latterly, I think, in any other context than that, but for 70 years of their lives had been saying that rhyme, and they weren't aware of the things that we're aware of now, and the power of words, and also, you know, the fact that, you know, it was used as a slur in the United States and was thankfully being, you know, phased out and addressed in that. We weren't as international then as we are now. We didn't have access to international attitudes, and indeed a lot of people at this time wouldn't have even known any people of colour, and if they had, would probably have been very nice to them, but would have still used language that a person of colour would find offensive, and certainly a person of colour from today. But that again, I think, takes on a different tone and a different context in the 1960s. So all I can say is, it's a word I would never use. I really hate racism. I would hope, if this was ever found, it should all go out as absolutely broadcast. Not that. Take it out. Absolutely take it out. But I'm reluctant to, and I even saw when Peter Purvis said, who I think is a Brexiteer, said something about Brexit, recently, a few people sort of again went online and made the bizarre connection that, oh yeah, well, he's probably racist then because he was also in the Doctor Who story that had the N-word. And I mean, those two things have got precisely nothing to do with each other. And also, you can be, I'm not a Brexiteer myself, but you can be a Brexiteer and also not a racist. And I know Peter Purvis quite well, and he's not a racist. And I think tarring people with that brush is equally egregious. So I think it's complicated. I think it's unpleasant. I think there's a lot of toxicity around these sorts of conversations, which is why I try to ignore them. Not because I don't think they're important, and it's not right to call out, you know, inappropriate and unpleasant language, but I also, as I say, question the wisdom of thinking that we can somehow have some form of catharsis by, you know, calling out an event from the past that we were not privy to, and that we should not be so quick to judge, because there are words and expressions and things that we say now that in 20 years' time people might come and say, you know, when you said that, that was really out of order. And we go, what? Hang on, no, because when we were saying it, it was fine. And I don't know anything much about Campbell Singer, but, you know, a lot of men of his age in the UK at that time had fought against fascism and done braver and better things than I would ever do. So I'm reluctant to call them out from the comfort of my 21st century perspective and, you know, all the good work that has been done, not by me, but by people that came before me, to educate and to change language and all of that. So I'm very, very sympathetic to, and also I think it takes on a different tone if you're a person of colour talking about this, but I'm not. You know, I can only talk from my perspective, and again, I think we have to be very watchful and sympathetic to anything that you know would open up some extremely sort of painful thoughts and experiences. But I'm talking about this purely objectively as an historical artifact, not anything else. And I, as I say, I think it should go. And I'm entirely sympathetic to people who, you know, find themselves very vexed and discombobulated by this. I said I wouldn't spend too much time on it because I don't think I have anything valuable to add. But the long and the short of it is, I really wish it wasn't there. If the episode was found and released, I think it should be taken out. But I also think it wasn't as terrible. I mean, the Agatha Christie book didn't change its title till 1985, I don't think. So it was, you know, as again, I mean, I remember actually saying when I did Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Moe, when I was about 7, I used to say, Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Moe, catch a racist by the toe. I reclaimed it. That's how sort of liberal my household was, and how, you know, very good my mum had been at making sure we, you know, we were aware of such things. But you know, isn't it good that we've moved on from that? Anyway, I spent far too much time on that, but I am sympathetic to people who want that addressed, because it's not very nice hearing it in our favourite television programme. But it's not in the camera script. It's an ad lib. But as I say, I don't think that means that Campbell Singer was trying to smuggle racist attitudes into children's television program. He was saying a nursery rhyme he'd said all his life. So Dodo's getting frozen here, which is great, because it puts her in jeopardy. I mean, Dodo doesn't really. I've just talked about how much we have learned over many, many years. Dodo, during the Celestial Toymaker, does not really learn many lessons. There's a lot of, this was fun, wasn't it? Oh, Stephen, shall we do this now? Now, remember, Dodo, it's a bad version of the game. But they're carrying it with their spots and their stripes, and I do like her hat. I like her tomboy look. I think she looks funky and fun and cute. I quite like this metal chair. It doesn't look very comfortable, and it does actually look like it's got quite phallic adornments on it, looking at it now. But how, I have not seen loads of these cards, these pictures of the playing cards people. Yeah, it is pretty grim, isn't it, how they decide to sacrifice the Joker. And Peter Stevens is perfect casting. He is, of course, Lolim in The Underwater Menace, and is a great deal of fun. He looks like an actor who could... he's perfect casting for the Billy Bunter, as we will see later. But isn't it fun how... At this time, you get quite a few actors who appear in a Doctor Who story around this time in the 60s, and then appear in one, not that long afterwards. Stephen Dartnell in Keys of Marinus, and then the Sensorites, Terence Woodfield in the Daleks' Master Plan, then the Ark, Richard Beale in the Ark, and then the Gunfighters, and Peter Stevens here, and then in the Underwater Menace. But again, there was so much being made, and stuff was in one cathode ray and out the other. Does it work like that? I don't know. I like this. That for all their sort of slightly larger than life, they're not rounded characters. Amidst all that sort of strangeness and the fact that they're animated playing cards, they have that moment where they decide that they will sit and go together, and that for all their nonsensical nature, their almost clownish aspect, within them there is a sort of touching humanity. And then, of course, the minute that they exhibit that and they sit down, they are reduced then to being playing cards again. I think that's very effective. I think that and the many ways of death on the chairs is superb. I think both of those things are great. It happened again. I mean, don't emphasize that it's pretty much the same episode ending as before, where you've opened a TARDIS, you get a rhyme, and then you prepare to play the next game. And it's a bit, this is a bit weird as well, isn't it? Because it's like, oh yeah, and the rhyme that we got at the beginning of this episode, that actually hasn't come true yet. But I like this. I like the fact that the Toymaker phones them using the phone in the phones. I always, because that, again, that seems weird. It's just a man talking in the phone, but it's the phone coming out of what in this show is, is a TARDIS. Even though it's a fake TARDIS, but it's a TARDIS rather than a phone box, and the Toymaker is talking to Stephen through it. I think that's strange. I think that's weird. I think that's slightly unsettling. I think that adds to the vulnerability and the fact that the TARDIS has been, invaded and stolen. That the Toymaker will use the TARDIS phone, even though it's a fake TARDIS, to talk to our heroes and issue the instructions. I think that works. Again, that creates the sort of dissonance and strangeness that this story is crying out for. And the dolls. Yeah, and Luce Cannon have done an absolutely terrific job with this. I mean, I don't know where they've sourced all these photos from, but they're absolutely gorgeous. And out come the dolls. And that's the episode ending. I mean, It's not a kill them now, or they've the Doctor's dead. No, it's some weird dancing ladies coming out of the TARDIS. I'm sorry I got distracted. I'm by a mumbled sotto voce offensive word, and I probably haven't satisfied anybody with my response, but well, I've said what I've said. I'm nothing if not an equivocator, which probably is not to my credit. Perhaps people who are firmer one way or the other are the people that really make changes to the world. But I don't know. You need peacemakers too. And anyway, I think that, you know, it is quite a laboured episode in the sense that, you know, that they are essentially choosing different chairs to sit in. I mean, that's all the drama. And Michael Gough's occasionally cuts back to Michael Gough to speak to somebody who isn't there. But there's plenty to recommend. The set design is excellent. All of the actors do a good job. I think the set design is beautiful. I think the imagery is absolutely fantastic. I think the costume design is great. I think those playing cards look like playing cards, which I think is rather marvellous. I love the bit where they sit down at the end together. I think that's really charming and really sad. And then when they turn into playing cards, that's really quite strange and unsettling. But I think the thing that the episode does best is that it's got these different chairs and each one kills you in a different way. And that is, you know, base level excitement. It's the variety of the dispatch. It's the, you know, playfulness of the sadism. It's, you know, that is what the toy maker is, isn't he? He's somebody who likes to play. And even the act of, you know, destroying his opponents is playful booby traps that are not all the same, that have their own particular way of doing it. And that's something that I think, you know, really turns you on as a kid, because it's the sort of thing you dream up yourself as well. You'd go, oh, I've got that thing that's a shark pit, and that thing that's got spikes, and that thing, you know. I think that's, you know, kids quite like sort of the variety of sadism. It's the ones who have to do it all exactly the same way, they're the ones I think you have to worry about, because they're the ones that'll keep doing it till they get it right. So Toby, getting remarkably close to the psyche of a serial killer there. I don't quite know where that came from. So for me, with honourable mention, well, to the set design, to the costume design, but to what I nearly chose, which was the King and Queen of Hearts sitting down together amidst all the madness, that tender moment, which I do think is very, very sweet. I'm going to choose the fact that the chairs kill you in lots and lots of different ways. What is Kieran going to choose for thing two?
Second thing I like is the performances. I think the sustained absence of William Hartnell throughout the story really gives Peter Purvis his chance to shine, because he's basically carrying most of the story as the lead protagonist, and he fulfills the Doctor's role with Dodo as his companion in a way. And, you know, Michael Gough and Carmen Silvera and Campbell Singer give great performances, particularly them as their three distinctly separate different characters, which is very impressive considering those weren't the characters that they were originally hired to play.
Yes, that's very true. I think Kieran may be going for general things for each of his things, which is fine. You play the game any way you like. Well, what an appropriate story to cite that rule in. I mean, I suppose if he was playing in the Toymaker's rules, what he'd do is he'd choose a favourite thing from Colony in Space or The Curse of Fenric, because the Toymaker is prone to cheat. But anyway, I think the performances are great for all the reasons that Kieran, who also, I just noticed there, has a kind of Toymaker coat on and definitely has Stephen's stripy T-shirt on underneath. So isn't that exciting? Now, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to finish, and this is going out to my patrons first. So, hey, patrons, did I spend too much time talking about the thorny issue of the unpleasant word? And should I go back and cover that portion of the episode again and actually talk about the episode? I don't know. It's tricky. But I've done what I've done. So non-patrons, you might not hear any or much of what I have originally said, or you might hear it all, in which case, you know, I've taken it seriously enough to ask people what they think. But I hope you know I come to this with a good heart, and I always listen to other people's perspectives, and I know that things are complicated and mean different things to different people as well. And I'm certainly, you know, one thing I'm certain about is that, you know, my perspective isn't the only one, and I respect those of other people. And I think the more we try to respect, you know, various perspectives on quite thorny and complicated issues, the more we can, you know, accept them and digest them and be thoughtful about them, and then, you know, try to put those thoughts and lessons and ponderings into the way that we conduct ourselves towards other people. Because at the end of the day, the most important thing is how we deal with and treat people today, now, based on things that we've learnt and continue to learn. And I will also continue to learn. But when it comes to Doctor Who, what I really like to do is to sort of enjoy it for what it is, have fun with it, and actually use it to escape the real world. And now more than ever, I mean, the world outside is, as I speak, is grim and cruel and unpleasant, and people are arguing with each other about that. And again, you see the different arguments being placed, and I can, you know, see the perspectives of all the people making those arguments. And, you know, there's a lot of people not doing that right now, and it's really hard. And it may be cowardly of me, but I don't think so, to go and, you know, I know what I think about current affairs and things, but also I'm also prepared to be wrong. But when it comes to Doctor Who, it's nice to, you know, it's the place, to evoke a story title, it takes you away. And that's, I think, what I try to do in my broadcasting about it as well, is to, you know, make sure it takes us to that place that makes us content, that makes us happy, that gives us joy and thrills and escapism. And yeah, it can provoke thoughtful debate as well. But I'm aware that there's a gossamer thin line between that and, you know, toxic back and forths. And I don't really want to get involved in those. So there we go. Am I going to do most of this one again, or is it all right? Who knows? I will find out at the end of the day of November the 3rd, 2023. So when you're listening to this in March 2024, this, like the episode that I've just watched, may not actually exist anymore. And I may have had to recreate it using minimal resources, but if it's anything to like loose cannons, a lot of skill. That's been a real triumph of doing this. They've done an absolutely fantastic job. So seek out their recon of the episodes, because, and those photographs, we are so lucky with the plethora of beautiful photographs we have from this obviously quite handsome production. We don't actually see that so much in the final episode, I don't think, either. I think the final episode is the least representative. So that will bring things to talk about when the pictures start to move, but they're not going to move next time. The Hall of Dolls will be the last time this Celestial Toymaker is a series of frozen fragments. But that's what we've got next time. So until then, keep dancing. Thanks ever so much for listening to Happy Times and Places, which is presented by me, Toby Haydock, and my special guest this time around is Kieran Hyman, who is on Instagram at HymanKieran. I'm grateful to him and to the patrons who make these podcasts possible, and they include Ruben Herfindahl, Stephen Moffat, Craig Wallace, Rick Moran, John Williams, Aaron Krokilovsky, Matthew Harris, Graham, don't have your surname, Graham, Julian Bashford, Angus Gulliver, Paul Jones, Man in a Skirt Alert, Jim Trenowden, John Molyneux, David Brody, Michael Harvey, Steve Walker, Sarah Crotzer, P. Baker, Jim Mooney, Andrew Jolly, David James Wilson, Dale Smith, Oliver Crocker, Paul Greaves, David Smith, Peter Burns, James Curray Smith, Peter Harness, Ronald Hayden, Rob Leonard, Christopher Meredith, Gavin McLean, Richard Straw, Neil Tate, and Nick Tedston. The music is by Dave Gates, the artwork by Dylan Patterson. if you enjoyed listening to this podcast more than I enjoyed saying it out loud, then please go to patreon.com/Toby Haydock. It's the modern way of doing things where self-employed artists like myself put our stuff out there, and you can optionally choose. That's the thing about options. You choose them. That's the thing about choosing. It's optional. I don't know. Anyway, you go to this place, this, treasure trove called patreon.com/Toby Haydock, and you can get for as little as £3 a month. You can go up the tiers, but everything pretty much is available at the lowest tier. It's very much a, this is what I can afford and prepared to pay for what I'm getting, which I think is quite a nice system. You get advance releases, you get bonus releases, you get special stuff that's just for you. You get monthly AMAs, you get pictures of my dog, and you get behind the scenes stuff from the Blu-ray features I make and any sort of television bits and bobs that I do, and sometimes some work in progress. So, you know, I try and make it worth your while if you're interested in me beyond, you know, just listening to these podcasts, which I know is a very niche interest, but if you'd like to fill my niche, then I'm going to leave that metaphor there. You can go to patreon.com/Toby Haydock. And it's just a monthly sort of subscription. You're 6 months in advance for Happy Times and Places, and a few months in advance for some of the other things, like Too Much Information and Indefinable Magic, although I need to do some more of those. But I'm currently in the midst of... There's going to be other stuff. When I can't be doing those, it's because I'm doing other stuff, and you get access to those as well. If you don't want to do the monthly subscription, you can go to ko-fi.com/Toby Haydock if I've done a release you particularly like, or if I sound particularly hungry or needy, or if you are suddenly very flush, but only for a month. But if you cannot or don't want to pay, that is, of course, totally acceptable. I listen to loads of podcasts I don't pay for, and that is the way of things these days, and that is the expectation. We fling this stuff out there, and it's nice to have the interest. But what costs you nothing and really does help is to go to iTunes and Podbean and Spotify and all those places and give these 5 stars. And if you could leave a few lines of review as well, that helps just buff the algorithms up and put a song into an old man's heart. You can also do the social media thing. I am on Twitter at Toby Haydock. Will people be calling it X in the 6 months after I've recorded this that most people listen to it? Will you have gone to X? I still say Opal Fruits, not Starburst. So it's unlikely. It's Twitter. It is an X Twitter, but it is still Twitter and not X. Whatever you call it, these podcasts have their own feed as well, which is at Haydock Podcasts. And I have Instagram at toby.haydock. I'm trying to get better at Instagram. I'm putting videos out there. There's a lot of stuff from my comedy club there, which has, you know, special guests like Joe Lycett and Sarah Millican and all sorts of people. So, you know, if you think I'm amusing and would like to experience some of that where I sometimes don't mention Doctor Who, then my comedy club has its own feed on Twitter at XS Malarkey. That has its own Instagram feed as well. And I have a page on Facebook that you can follow and like and all of that. But if you like and subscribe to any of the things that I do, again, in this modern media landscape, that really does help. Because I've known people miss out on getting parts in things because the other person that they're up against has more followers. The humanity. So it's a dirty game, but please help me play it. I'm not going to do much of a post credits on this one partially because I don't I might have to revisit it and do it again because I'm not sure about it. Yes, it's given me pause for thought, but I have to, you know, I have to be honest, don't I? I think that's all I can try to be, not try and, you know, say what I think people want me to say, but just be honest. And I know that my heart is pure, but I also, you know, I do question some of the more, you know, some of the received wisdom or some of the things that I know it would probably be easier for me to say, but I don't actually think. Now, I could be wrong, and that's fine, but and I don't mind being wrong, but if I don't actually think something, I don't want to say it just to be pleasing, which is weird because all I want to do is please, and all I want is that the approval of others. It's terribly craven. It goes a long back into my childhood. This is why I think I do what I do, he said, suddenly psychoanalyzing himself. But anyway, I'm not out there going, this is me, and take it or leave it. I sort of want to go, I just want everyone to get on and be nice. But I have to say what I think. And as I say, I could be wrong. And I certainly don't have, bad intent. And I certainly think, racism is bad and should be called out. But I'm sort of troubled. I'm not sure the way that we deal with this sometimes in the modern age is helpful and also historically accurate. And, my brain is such that I'm a stickler for accuracy. But again, as I say, I could be wrong. But if I'm wrong, just let me be wrong. That's okay. You can be wrong and not bad. I've been wrong about a lot of things. In fact, I might do a podcast about all the things I've got wrong. God, that will be so painful. But will it be freeing? Will it be freeing to go, here are the bits in books and magazine articles and DVD commentaries that I've got wrong? So you don't have to say anything about them anymore. But then somebody will rush to Wikipedia and go, and here are the things Heydoke has got, mistakes. Yeah, TV appearances, personal life, errors in Doctor Who broadcasts. Oh, God. But they're factual errors rather than errors of interpretation, which is what I think this is. But anyway, I suppose it's interesting. But I do find it painful. I do find it awkward because you're so worried about, saying the wrong thing and offending somebody. I don't want to offend anybody. It's really hard, isn't it? But that's okay. Let's all treat each other with the respect that we're all just trying to find our way in the world the best way possible, and our opinions are based on, experience and, but also, that intent. Certainly, I think in this corner of the internet, obviously not everywhere, but let's make that here. Oh, 2023. Yeah, navigating you is a tricky thing, especially for an old man. You're not that old, Toby. Well, I know, but part of me quite likes being out of touch. It's safe. These people go, well, he's just out of touch. Oh, okay, then that's fine. Yeah, he bumps into things. and his waterworks aren't quite as efficient as they used to be. Let him go. Let him go. Just let him. Let him fade into oblivion. Let him be invisible. Let him play his games invisibly. And now and again, we'll let you see his hand.